an abuse of power is not a person who should hold power.
And we will see what happens. Again, the confirmation hearing has been held, but Rodney Scott has not yet been confirmed by the full Senate to be head of Border and Customs Patrol. That does it for our show. Andrea Guerrera, we thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of the San Diego Alliance. You can visit democracynow.org to see all the coverage we've done on the death of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the One World of Community Radio.
FM WRHU Hempstead, Radio Hofstra University, 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio, at 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh. I'm Ricky Hubert, and you're listening to the One World Radio Show. We also have the fabulous Lydia Makhwanana joining us in Cape Town, South Africa. Lydia, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic, thank you. How are you, Ricky?
I'm all right. We were talking before we got on that we both have papers due because it's that time of year. That time of year, I have something due as we're taping this due tomorrow, and you have something due later today. But the beautiful thing is, Lydia, by the time this airs, we'll be done with it and it'll be out of our hands.
Definitely. Like, I can't wait until the submission time and I am done.
I think we all can relate to that. I think all the students finish strong because we're getting closer to the end. So you guys, you're going into winter now, right?
We are heading into winter, so it's the last legs of autumn on our side. So yeah, getting ready for winter, my favorite season.
So, oh, yeah. I like winter too. I'm a winter person. Maybe we'll find out what our guest's favorite season is when we get to talking to him. So our guest today, because not just Lydia and I talking, it's we have a wonderful guest today, Dr. Chedrai Kumanyika. And Chedrai, thanks so much for coming on our show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Thank you. So for those who aren't familiar with your work, tell everybody a little bit about what you do.
Well, I'm an assistant professor in New York University's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. I teach a variety of things to do with journalism and media, but I also make podcasts and the documentary kind of storytelling kind of podcasts. And so I recently released a podcast called Empire City.
So you're a professor of journalism. You work in podcasting. I think there's a point in everyone's career, kind of, if they're passionate about something, which I assume you are based on the work that you've done. When did you first get the bug for journalism and storytelling?
I spent a lot of time, particularly, I would say, between 2005 and 2013, listening to public radio. I mean, I listened to public radio before that. I grew up, but I really started honing in and really becoming a real fan during those years. I think it was during those years where, you know, you're driving around. I was driving around living in different places, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and just listening to the radio, I was like, wow, you know, this is like incredible storytelling, listening to like This American Life and some of those shows, but also listening to interviews and shows. Like, there was a show called The Combat Jack Show that was a podcast. And so I think that was when I really got the bug, because I realized there are incredible stories. I'm learning a lot. And then because it's radio, it's reaching all these people in ways that, you know, typically like scholarly work doesn't.
So you really listened to it from 2005 to 2013. You had mentioned that the reach of radio. What was it about kind of the storytelling? Because audio journalism, I feel like, isn't something that's as prominent as visual journalism. Like, we were having someone discuss the other day. They were doing something about food, and they said that's visual journalism because it's good for the ear. No, good for the eye, rather. My apologies. Visual journalism, good for the eye. But you're talking about stories for the ear. So why do you think that's so powerful? What got you kind of hooked into that? And how did you use that public radio sphere to get into your own work and what you were doing?
Well, I think there was two things about radio that really caught me. One is, you know, I mean, you know, we have a saying in radio that, you know, radio has the best pictures. And I think when people say that, what they mean is that because you're listening, you have to kind of create the pictures and images in your own mind. And in that way, it requires like a different kind of mind, like your brain switches to a kind of a different mode. You know what I mean? And at the same time, you know, that idea of someone's voice telling you a story in your ear, that's probably like one of the oldest, you know, human forms of sharing information, sharing ideas. And even as an individual, like, we know the voices of our parents and our family probably before we're even born, right? Because you can hear them in the womb. So I think that there's like something very intimate about that. And also, one other thing I'll say is that at a time in the world where a lot of people have made up their minds what they think about different issues, I found that, you know, radio that tells a good story is a good way to surprise people. I found myself surprised, right? You follow the story because you don't know where it's going. You don't know where it's going to land. And in that way, you're maybe more open to have your mind changed in ways that fairly rare, I think, in today's times.
So what got you invested? Because you said you had listened to radio all your life, right? You listened to public radio. So when did you first discover that you wanted to go into journalism? Was it at a younger age? Was it through that time listening? And kind of tap into that a little bit.
I mean, I did my first formal radio sort of like podcasting workshop in 2013. It was the Transom Workshop, and it was led by Rob Rosenthal and Jay Allison and David Weinberg and others. But I guess I should rewind a little bit to say that, you know, one of the big things that influenced my career was that I was in a hip hop group for a long time, starting in basically in 1995. And I've been a hip hop artist for like a huge chunk of my life, going all the way back to probably like fifth grade. So that was where I first got used to kind of like hearing my voice, experimenting with my voice, really listening closely to other media. And, you know, because hip hop is also a place where great stories are told. I think that that influenced me. And I also, you know, I learned how to use Pro Tools. I learned how to use production equipment and kind of demystify that stuff. So I was doing all of that, really, I would argue, from the time I was in fifth grade all the way up to when I became a professor. But I think part of what made me really want to get the bug, I was in graduate school at Penn State University, and I was learning all this amazing stuff, but most of it was in like these scholarly journals, which is fine. I mean, I think some research should circulate within the scholarly community because it just, you know, this is what has to happen for us to kind of solve some of our problems, is that people have to be able to talk about it. But I said, man, I want my work to get out to more people. And then I heard an invitation to the Transom Workshop. I probably heard it on public radio, probably on This American Life, where they said there's an organization called Transom and it can teach you how to make radio. And if you had to apply, it was competitive. So I said, you know what, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring. I applied and I was, you know, accepted. And that was how it all started for me. But in a way, I was drawing on my history as a hip hop artist.
So you didn't think that you weren't going to say that you were a hip hop artist and not have us ask you more about the hip hop stuff that you did, right? So how'd you get invested in hip hop? Was that what you wanted to make like your living doing when you were younger? Was that the plan?
Like a lot of young people, you know, you're listening to the music that's out, you know, whatever. Like, you know, if you turn on the radio and you hear people. I was growing up right as hip hop was really kind of taking off. And I remember listening to hip hop and then trying out to see if I could write my own rap. So I was writing my own songs and raps when I was in fifth grade. I used to write them, and then we would come to the schoolyard and we would get in like these hip hop battles. And I think it was great in the sense that it really, you know, this was stuff. I mean, keep in mind, we had no conception of making money. We were doing this purely for joy and I would say probably the glory, because what the payment was like being cool. You know, if you could rap and you won a battle, you would be like the coolest kid at the school. So I got that way. But also I want to say that like hip hop back then, the kind of stuff I was listening to was really challenging and opening my mind. Right. I sometimes. You know, I think about Rakim writing a line like, he says something like, I start to think and then I sink into the paper like I was ink. When I'm writing, I'm trapped in between the lines. I escape when I finish the rhyme. I'm hearing that when I was in like fifth and sixth grade, this guy talking about writing and sinking into the page and the power of it, or songs by KRS-One where he would talk about creativity. You know, and what it really meant to be creative and why creativity was more important than competition. So like all those ideas. And then there were also things about history and culture I was learning through rap that I wasn't necessarily learning in school, about Black history and about those kinds of things and about the real story of American history. So all those things I was learning in hip hop. Now, of course, hip hop is not, you know, there's also stuff that's, you know, problematic that we should think about. But I would argue that's the nature of art. That's the case with movies. It's the case with television. You know, art is supposed to bring you into controversial spaces. So that was why I really got into it. And then I said, I want to try my hand at it. And, you know, I was pretty good. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you were saying. I think you're the first guest we've ever interviewed that started rapping in the middle of the interview. That was excellent. So you did hip hop for a little. How long did you do hip hop for? You never did it professionally.
I mean,
right?
I technically never stopped doing hip hop, but I would say that in what happened was in 1995, we formed a group called The Spooks, based on a book called The Spook That Sat by the Door by Sam Greenlee. And in 1999, we got a record deal, and, you know, we made a record that was kind of a hit record all over the world. It was called Things I've Seen, and it went gold in France first. And then it went gold in like Belgium and Sweden. And then we got a gold album in the UK. So I spent the years from between 1999 and like 2006 just touring all over, you know, the world, really everywhere. Turkey we spent a lot of time. Most of our time was in Europe because we had all those gold records in Europe. So, you know, we did like shows like Top of the Pops and some of those big shows in the UK, like Jules Holland. Here in the States, we were successful, but we weren't quite at the top of the charts in the way we were in Europe. And I don't know. I mean, I think that maybe had something to do with the fact that our music was a little bit alternative. Like we had a singer. We were kind of like the Fugees, but not quite as talented. So yeah, well, I got to live that life as a full-time rapper and really also observe. I think that's what got me interested in media. I got to see, you know, when you're doing interviews and flying around to different countries, you know, you really start to see how the media machine works, how public relations works. I was watching media in different countries, different languages. And you really realize like, oh, wow, you see the influence of culture and media on the world. You know, I guess at that time I felt like I was a part of it. And so, yeah, that was a big, big part of my life. And I got to travel to places I probably would not have gotten to travel. But like this, I may have traveled to some of those same places, but certainly not under the same circumstances. It's different when you're a gold selling hip hop artist.
And so you had like all this fame doing it. So what kind of got you to stop and when the group went away? Because you went to grad school. When did you go to undergrad?
I went to undergrad between the years of 1991 and
1995. Oh, okay. So what did you study at that point?
I studied African and African American studies. That was what my major is in. And I just, by the way, Penn State just gave me a sort of outstanding alumnus recognition. So that was great because I got to study, you know, really important parts of history and culture. I got to study African literature. I got exposed to all kinds of important artists and literature, and I got to undertake history. And, you know, again, I would argue that what I was getting exposure to was real history of this country. It was unfortunately not, you know, I had some teachers early on who really tried, but was not necessarily in like the formal curriculum, like in terms of like the real history, and certainly not something that a lot of people knew. And I think that that's important because I think that in those times was when I was also setting the stage for what I would do as a podcaster, because almost all of my podcasts that have been really successful have focused on history. Uncivil focused on a people's history of the Civil War, telling stories about the Civil War that are not, you know, well known, but really important. My show Empire City is about the police, the history of the NYPD, the real history of the NYPD. And I would argue that, you know, there's over 18,000 police departments in the country, but it's very hard to get a real history of the police. You will not get a real history of the police if you go to most websites of those police departments. So, and then I made another history called Seen on Radio. I've done some work with that podcast, Seen on Radio. I did two seasons. One was on the history of the idea of whiteness, which is really like the sort of some of the history of racial ideas. I did another one on the history of American democracy. And in some ways, we learn how hard Americans fought against, at least powerful Americans fought against the idea of democracy. That was not something that they signed on to very easily. So anyway, but like that again, so all my work has been history, and I've gotten now millions and millions of listeners and downloads. But in a way, it started, you know, or an important part of my education on that was during those undergrad years at Penn State.
Like in podcasts, like how did that come about for you? I was listening to you talking about media and everything. So how, in what point in time in your life, you're like, you know what, let me start a podcast.
Right. Well, as I mentioned before, you know, I took the Transom workshop. I had just finished my PhD in mass communication. I applied for this Transom workshop, which was a workshop that teaches you how to make, you know, documentary style narrative podcasts. And I took this week long workshop, and, you know, it was really hard. I mean, it was like, listen, we were under pressure. So many of us were in tears at the end of that week. It was like that high pressure cooker of a process. After that, I wrote about that process. And what I wrote about was my voice and how I was trying to imitate what I thought a professional voice was supposed to sound like. But in doing that, I wasn't really being me. I wasn't necessarily being authentic, or, you know, I wasn't like the voice of Chenjerai the rapper had kind of disappeared. And so I wrote about that, and a lot of people related to that and started reaching out, because there were a lot of people who are working in radio, working in podcasting, or maybe people who wanted to, but have been told or felt that their voice wasn't good enough. And so my piece helped kind of say, like, public radio should be about recognizing all the different ways people speak. And that's the only way we can really understand the world. So after people reached out, I did a lot of radio interviews. And then the first podcast that I made was Uncivil. You know, someone I sort of reached out, you know, someone from Gimlet Media reached out to me and was like, hey, we'd love to work with you if you think about it. And I said, yeah, I want to work on this project. So that I made Uncivil. Uncivil was really successful and wound up, you know, getting millions of downloads. And we actually won a Peabody Award. And so that was kind of like the first big podcast. And the same year, I started working on Scene on Radio, which, like I said, was about the history of racial ideas and whiteness. And that podcast also was nominated for a Peabody Award. The George Foster Peabody Award is a very prestigious, you know, media award sort of here in the States. And so that was a kind of those were my first two big podcasts. And they were it wasn't my first one. Everybody should know my first podcast was the one I made for the workshop, and it was terrible. But your first work probably always will be terrible. And that's good. Because you can't hold ourselves to if we expect to be perfect the first time around, we're not committed to the process of growing. So it's fine. All our first work is going to be bad. And my first podcast, it was a 5-minute podcast about a fisherman, and it was not good. But then I learned, and I had teams, and I practiced. And then my next two podcasts were really good. They won Peabody Awards.
And thank you for highlighting that the first few works are not good, because we forget that we're human sometimes and that we want everything to be perfect. But no, first you will go a bit slight different. But yeah, as time goes by, you will be perfect in it. And throughout your career, you've explored how historical myths shape our understanding of issues like race and policy. How did you approach this dismantling these myths in your work? Like, how did you approach it?
I remember when I was younger reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. And Malcolm X, for anyone who doesn't know, could argue that he was a civil rights figure, although toward the end of his life, he saw himself as a human rights figure. And he made an important comment. He said, of all our studies, history is best equipped to reward our research. And I kind of know what he means. The more I read history, I remember when I was in graduate school, I would just notice that the people who studied history, they just seemed to understand a lot of things better than other people. Not always. History isn't the only discipline. But so I wanted to, when it came to understanding myths about what America is, I said, I want to understand the history. You know, I want to understand how did we get here? And so, for example, when it came to policing, my question was, why did the first police department start? Right? That's a historical question. Who were the actors who started this department, and what did they say about what they wanted to do and what actually occurred? You know, most of the conversations and myths about policing, for example, don't start with that question. They just start, you know, someone might say, well, the world is really scary. There's lots of bad criminals and bad people, and we have to do something about them. So it's almost like you're starting with fear. And then you're not asking, but I said, okay, that's, you know, granted, there's a lot of danger in the world for sure. But one important historical question was, were the police started with the purpose of actually keeping people safe, especially where they started with keeping people like me and my family safe from that danger? And, you know, the historical answer, when you look to that, is a very clear no. There's no, you know, it's like, it's not even really in dispute. But the other reason why I think that history is important is because it gives people a set of facts that you can have to grapple with. So it's history. Of course, there's different interpretations of history. Not all historians agree. But, you know, when historians disagree, Lydia, they have to bring evidence and facts to the table and say, well, here's my facts. What do we make of this? What do we make of that? So I said, what I want to do is I want to just tell a story about history that can allow other people to make up their mind. I'm going to lay out to you objectively what happened. And if there's an area where I don't have the information, I'm going to tell you that. I'm going to say, look, we're not sure what happened here, but here's what the evidence looks like. And I thought that that could bring everybody to the table, because I find that when you start a conversation about these kind of historical ideas or myths about whatever it is, race, policing, whatever it is, a lot of people kind of freeze up on you because people already have what they think their opinion is. But when you tell people a story that includes facts, you know, and that's based on facts, people kind of are interested, because if nothing else, they want to be entertained. So we tried to also make the other way I've approached this, Lydia, is I really have tried to make my stories entertaining. We put a lot of emphasis on making entertainment. It's kind of like you could call it edutainment, right? Because it's educating people, actual, objective, based on records. I'm happy to pull out all the receipts for anybody who has any questions, which I want to say, by the way, no one has had any questions, which is kind of amazing when you think about the kind of things I'm saying on this podcast, is that I've been surprised. Like, no, no one has surfaced with any kind of questions. But I'm also not surprised because we did such a deep dive in the research on it that I was like, well, if somebody wants to challenge what I'm saying, they're going to have to do a very deep dive. We did it. I mean, it took us, you know, like 4 or 5 years to make this show.
That is absolutely amazing, work that you're doing through the podcast. And looking at social media right now, like, how has social media transformed the way we engage with historical narratives and social justice issues, in your opinion?
Well, I think there are definitely pros and cons to social media. I think I'm going to start with the bad so we can end on a positive note with the social media. I think what I'm worried about with social media is that it's open. Social media has lowered the barrier of access so people can weigh in to the public, right? I can go on Instagram, I can go on whatever it is, Blue Sky, and I can reach millions of people, right? Every day with the different messages. And so I think that's actually a good thing. The problem is that if I go on and offer my opinion on something, who's to say my opinion is based on anything factual? And if I'm really compelling, or I'm, you know, I don't have this problem, but, you know, like if, but if, like, you know, I'm really good looking or persuasive, I could probably fool people into believing that what I'm saying is factual. And the social media also operates at a speed. It's driven by, you know, algorithms, which are basically meant to kind of keep us trained on it. And so the most accurate content doesn't necessarily, you know, that's not necessarily the most successful or widespread content on social media. The content that is good for our health or teaching us things that we need to learn, those things tend to often not be the ones that are at the top of the social media algorithms, because that's not the kind of content that necessarily makes people feel like makes money or is clickable or whatever. So those are things I'm concerned about, because people who are primarily using social media for their information source, you're getting a really skewed version of the world because of all those things. On the positive side, though, I think that people have found really creative ways to do things like history on social media. There's so many history channels there, people telling stories, doing it in some ways even more engaging than the way I do, and doing it faster. You know, like, you'll see somebody in front of the screen and they'll be showing you the images, they'll be showing you the video footage, and they're narrating it and really making history something people can engage with. And then you can share it, right? And so it is kind of something that's reaching a lot of people. Like, how many, you see, if you can't see me right now, but if you could see me, you'll see I got all these books behind me. How many people are picking up these books? I wish people would pick up these books. I hope people listen to my podcast and want to pick up these books, but they're definitely on social media. So it's exciting that there's the content. You know, it doesn't have to be one or the other, right? Like, you can read a book, and then you can read the social media version of it and check that out. So I think I really respect social media creators, the way that they are opening up new ways to teach us.
Something you had touched on earlier, because we'll go into Empire City a little bit, because something you use with that is you use your father as kind of like a narrative point during the podcast, correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So you had mentioned something before when you were in the Transom workshop about using audio storytelling and podcasting and kind of putting your own narrative on and putting your own personal life into it, and how that can kind of connect you more with the listener, even with the world of public radio. We have a mutual connection that you have worked with my professor, Diane Hodson, and I took a course with her, and she would say to me, no, Ricky, no, you have to put more of your own personal life into this. You have to put more of your own narrative into this. Because I'm used to these formats where it's Lydia and I asking you questions and making you the focus. How do you, in your work in podcasting and audio storytelling, how do you incorporate your own personal life without making that the main focus and still telling an overall objective narrative?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it's true, right? I mean, the way journalism has worked for a long time, people felt like we as journalists are supposed to speak from this voice that is like sort of from the clouds, right? Like, we're not connected. We're not like flesh and blood people with struggles that you're going to hear through the mic. It's just like we're speaking this voice and kind of keeping it impersonal, maybe even keeping it really neutral. You're not supposed to weigh in with anything. It's almost like you're allowed to report, but you're not allowed to really come to the real conclusion and sometimes about what's going on, ways of doing radio that have been really common. But if you really want to cut through, you know, let's just, if I go back to when I listened to, when I was back listening to radio, when we, where we started out, listening to public radio, listening to podcasts early on, the thing that really cut it through was that they were personal. These are real people's lives. And there's something about a personal story that can cut through and make you understand the political stakes. You know, a lot of our situation we're in now in the world is people don't want to look at the stories that challenge their way of thinking. It's literally about avoiding taking a long look at something that might challenge how you think, you know, or taking a look at the difficult things in life, right? The uncomfortable things. And so the our people's personal stories are a way that can help people do that. So for me, I knew I was making a show about the police. I have experiences with police. We didn't use very many of those experiences in the show. Although we did, there is one experience I had while I was making the show where I got arrested at a protest. So we included that. More importantly, the question of understanding the police was connected to me understanding things that had happened to my father, because the NYPD targeted my father. They surveilled him. And the reasons why they targeted and surveilled him were not because he was doing things that were harming anyone, but because he was actually trying to fight for equality, right? There was a police brutality incident where the police beat up some guy. And my father was saying simply, this is wrong. And we would like more answers about what's going on here. That should not be controversial at all, right? The police targeted him and surveilled him. And I wanted to understand, how could taxpayers be paying an institution that was literally fighting democracy? You know, that's what I wanted to answer. And what was the history of that? So it was very related to my father. And then on the other side of it, I have a daughter who's 5 years old now. She was 4 years old during the, you know, important parts of us making the show. I mean, she really was like 3 and 4 while we were making the show, because we've been making it for a while. And she's sometimes starting to ask questions about police because she sees them everywhere. And, you know, I want to answer. I don't want to just answer in a way where I just tell her my opinions about the police. I want to tell her something that can allow her to form her own perspective. But I also don't want to lie to her. And, you know, I got to say, there is a way in which some of the popular media and the popular messages from police, I would say, do kind of tell don't really tell the full truth about the police, right? So I realized what I want to tell my daughter is the history. I want to tell her the same thing I want everyone else to know. And that way, if I'm just telling her the history, I said, listen, I'm going to tell you how we got here. I'm going to tell you the good, the bad, and the ugly. And then she can make up her mind. And really what my daughter needs to know is what everyone needs to know about this. And that's how I approached weaving it in a way that was relevant. Because I hear your point, Richard, but you know, you don't want to just make it about you in ways that doesn't relate to the subject. It has to have a real kind of authentic connection to the topic you're dealing with. But when it does, it works. Like, those personal moments are a lot of people's favorite parts of my show because they can really feel it.
I'm curious, with Empire City, what feedback have you heard, and how has that kind of changed your own way of going about the content you create in the podcast that you do?
I've mostly heard positive feedback. I mean, the puzzle here is that, like, often if people are thinking negatively, like if there's people who didn't like the idea that I was going to think critically about the police, most of those people aren't going to sit and listen to 8 whole episodes that are like 30, 40 minutes long. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm not saying that everybody like loves the podcast, but I will say that everybody who's listened, like all the feedback I get is overwhelmingly positive. Like I people are just like, wow, I didn't know this. I wish I knew more. Can you tell me it? Can you tell us more? I'm sharing this with my family. And, you know, that interestingly includes some working police officers. You know, I've had several working police officers reach out to me and say, you know, this, I really enjoyed your podcast and I learned a lot, and I shared it with other colleagues, retired police, who said, like, I think listening to this would actually help police to understand more about the history of the institution. So, you know, to me as a historian, you know, and I don't think that those people probably agree with everything I said, and they may not agree with me politically, but as a historian, my work, my job is to provide a history that's valuable to people, even those who disagree with me. So, but I haven't heard the disagreements. Mostly people are just like, I like it. It's interesting. I never knew that. Sometimes there's people who are like, I have another story. You know, that's another thing about this kind of history. When you open up a people's history where you're telling people's experience, that makes other people realize like, oh, wow, I have history in my family. Like either I have a relative who was an officer, or I have relatives who had something happen to them at the hands of police officers. And so I get a lot of those reactions, too. I think that that's what I want. Right. Because I think that if we want to solve the problems that we have in front of us in society, we can all have different opinions on them. But what we have to know is the facts about how we got to this point. Everybody needs those facts. And if you think the problems are too great, but we don't have time to learn the history, I think that's wrong. You know, Khalil Gibran Muhammad has said that if you look, one field where people really respect history is the medical field, right? Look at doctors. And if you think doctors aren't under time pressure, when somebody comes into a doctor's office and they're like, something's hurting, it's like the clock is ticking. You want to figure it out. But what's the first thing they have to do? They got to look at the person's medical history. Is this person diabetic? Does this person have a history of heart disease? Does this person have cancer? You know what I'm saying? Like if you don't do that historical analysis, you can't cure the patient. So what I'm saying is, in this case, our patient is society, and we don't know enough history. People don't have the patience for it, but that's where Chenjerai, and that's where Richard, and that's where Lydia come in, because we can make radio to make that history really exciting and entertaining for people.
That is so true, like history. And like you said, people are so tired of history, but history has so much answers for us to continue the future. It is right there at the back. That's how you learn our futures, through history. And with that being said, and looking at the work that you've been doing, looking back at your work so far, what achievements are you most proud of?
I mean, I'm happy that, you know, my work is assigned in schools and people use it to teach things, and it's, you know, different programs. It's out there. It's people, some community groups use it. So, and when I say my work, I should say our work, because nothing I've done is me, right, by myself. It's like, you know, Diane Hodson, who worked with me on Empire City, was an incredible contributor. I mean, she just added so much important decision making and editorial advice, and our whole team, senior Peter Bresnan, the whole list of credits, Sam Riddell, our sound designer. So it's a team effort, and I'm proud. And in some ways, I'm proud that I'm able to bring those kind of teams together to make something that's going to change how people understand history and understand the present moment. But I feel proud of that. But more than pride, I think I really just feel grateful. I'm just in gratitude, because there's a lot of people who are smarter, more talented than me, who haven't had the opportunities I've had. And so I take it very seriously, and I feel like, given all the struggles people are facing in the world, if I'm going to be in the position to have the platform and have the resources I have, I had better well use it to try to make the world a better place. So I feel grateful, and I feel responsible. That's what I feel more so than pride.
Now, you mentioned before you're an assistant professor at NYU Journalism at the Arthur. So how do you take all this work that you've done in the public radio podcasting space, and even in the history space, and incorporate that and give it back to the students in the classroom?
Well, you know, I teach a variety of journalism classes, and of course I bring my own experience. Sometimes I'll have some sections. Of course, journalism is bigger than the kind of journalism that I do. So I try to show my students all kinds of different approaches and ways of thinking about journalism, bringing in different journalists in. I use a lot of guest speakers, people who have different experiences. So that's, you know, when I'm teaching like a broadly, for example, I teach a class on the intro to journalism. I try to really bring in the people who are the experts and read about some of the ethics, go back and understand, you know, the First Amendment and freedom of speech and all those core things that people have to understand. And I talk about how it relates to my podcasts, but I also teach some courses that are specifically focused on podcasting. And, you know, it's great that I'm able to pull in my own work and pull in my own examples to talk about how I've navigated those situations, and or to, you know, in the context of the class, to reproduce what the writing room looks like, because students have to understand, like in this kind of documentary podcasting, writing is collaborative, right? A lot of writing is collaborative. It's like you have a draft of a script, people weigh in. They give you feedback. How do you give good feedback? How do you take the feedback, especially the feedback that's uncomfortable to take, that you don't like, where someone wants to chop something that you love or want you to build on something? Because I've been through that experience a lot, I can help students to understand, like, this is what it's like. And don't be scared of this, and don't be scared of how it makes you feel. You got to push through. Because, again, to return to an earlier point, the biggest lesson I want all my students to learn is that you get good at this by putting yourself out there, by making something that's imperfect, and then by continuing to just make it better. That's, you know, it's so intimidating, right? There's so many reasons to not put your own work out, including all the distractions and including just that it always seems like there's somebody better, or maybe the work you started isn't perfect, but you got to put it out there. You got to do it again. Toni Morrison, the incredible novelist who passed away not too long ago, RIP, you know, she said, I get up every morning and I write, she said, because I'm smarter in the morning. So by the time the afternoon hits, my brain energy goes down. So I also want to teach them those habits, I guess, of what I'm saying about consistently showing up to write and to create and revision. And I try to bring my experience. And, you know, again, having a podcast that has won some awards is helpful, because when I say it, it's like, I'm not saying it. I'm saying it as somebody who's done it. You know, it's different. It's different when you're saying it like, you know, I remember Jay-Z had a line where he said, everybody wants to tell you how to do it, but they never did it. You know what I mean? And it's like, I'm saying, well, no, I did it. And I'm telling you how to do it. But what I'm mainly telling you is believe in yourself, write, create, revise, revise, revise.
And that is so true. It's all about revising, being creative, you know. And I'd like to just get your opinion on something. When you talk about podcast and radio, right? Do you think podcast is slowly replacing radio?
I hope not. I mean, I think, you know, what I would see is that podcasting has learned from radio, is drawing on the best of what radio can, some of the best of what radio can do. I mean, podcast in a way is on demand, right? So it's like you can listen to it at your leisure. That's not always the case with radio. Radio, you know, comes on at a specific time. You got to tune in. So I like that it's done that. But there are some things that radio does that's hard to do in podcasting. For example, here in New York, I like to listen to the Brian Lehrer Show. It comes on from 10 a.m. to 12, and you hear it's a call-in show. It's a live call-in show. Now, there are live call-in podcasts, but, you know, it's on the radio, which means someone with a very cheap radio can hear it. They don't have to have fancy internet, be able to access the radio, so it's accessible. And all over the world, right, people have used radio, right, like in different contexts. Everybody from the Zapatistas to people in Algeria to people in South Africa. Like, the radio is a crucial tool for people connecting to each other. So I don't think podcasting can replace that. And I just hope that people have a tendency to get excited about the new technology. But I hope that we can do podcasting, but we can also maintain what's positive about community radio reaching out to people and allowing them to actually reach back to us, which is one of the things I think radio can be really good at. And actually, but maybe podcasting is not as good at that because it's not live. You know, you can't just call in. So I hope we can keep those values alive.
Something else that's interesting is, because you said about community radio, the show we're doing right now celebrates the power of community radio, because WRHU in Hempstead is a community radio station. Bush Radio in Cape Town is a community radio station. We have a couple community radio stations around the states that carry, and we have a station in Ireland that carries the program, which is really cool. So what do you think it is about community radio and public radio that maybe is more, for lack of a better term, powerful than commercial radio? What do you think it really is about community and public radio that speaks to people?
I think the whole idea of community radio and why it's so powerful is right there partially in the world, community, right? Ideally, community radio is based in a community of some sort, right? Like, your partner in South Africa is based in South Africa, in a community, right? Hofstra Radio is based there, right? All the incredible radio work going on at Hofstra. That's different than, like, media just coming in. You know how, like, there's an event and you see all the media come into a community, then they leave when that event is over? community radio is still there. So that's one thing, important thing. And I think that the mission of community radio is like, we really want to reach people with the information they need, you know, with culture, music, whatever the particular things are. It doesn't always have to be news all the time, but like that mission is important, that mission is first. Now in commercial radio, often, I'm not saying people don't work in commercial radio who have those same goals, but that word commercial, we got to look at it. If the word commercial is up front instead of community, that means that, you know, probably that specter of becoming really profitable and business is in play. And when business values start to lead the day, I mean, on the one hand, you know, everybody has to figure out the business model, how people are going to be paid, how you're going to keep the lights on. That has to be figured out. But commercial radio does have a way sometimes of like really prioritizing the most profit, adding a lot of ads that maybe aren't necessarily what we want, maybe not necessarily figuring out a way to keep certain shows alive, like the way that shows are valued and measured. Like if you're looking at a show and you're like, is this ultimately making money? If it's not, then we're not going to keep doing it, as opposed to like, this is something people really need, whether it's making money or not. Let's figure out, let's go to the people and get some, let's figure out how to fund this because this is important. So I think community radio is really good at keeping that mission up front. And of course, there's economic battles to be fought, right? But I think, you know, being responsive to a community. I mean, there are commercial radio stations that aren't even based in the locations that you're sort of hearing them. What happens if there's a weather event? What happens if there's a hurricane? What happens if there's something that happens in that local community? People need information right then about what to do in their local community. How do you... where's the flood hitting? Where's the hurricane hitting? What streets are blocked off? You got to be in the community to know those questions. You know what I mean? So like in the commercial radio that's broadcasting from some big city where they just kind of like are broadcasting through the channel, they can't respond as well to those kind of community issues. So I think there's nothing like community radio. We got to let it survive. We got to keep it alive. It's really important.
It's interesting what you said about the community, because when you were talking about getting the funds, we had back in, and I tell this story sometimes on this show, we had a fundraiser back in November 2023. We have cultural programming coming on the weekend, the Irish programming, and they raised over $10,000 in about 6 hours, 4 hours even, because the whole community, you had people all over calling in, coming to the station, friends, every family, everybody was coming down to support this cause. So I think there is something really powerful that you had mentioned, and I've seen it firsthand, so I'd agree with you on that. I want to go back more to the classroom for a second, because how long have you been teaching at NYU?
I've been teaching at NYU since the fall of 2022.
So something that I always find interesting when I talk to teachers is, because not only do you teach the students things, sometimes they teach you something along the way about your craft. What would you say is something that's a takeaway from your students and what they've taught you during this whole process?
I think there's two things. You know, one is that I remember when I first started teaching podcasting, I was actually at Rutgers University. And I remember all the men who came into my class, they were more interested in learning essentially how to do the kind of podcast that is more like you see it on TV, kind of like Joe Rogan. Like a lot of the men in my class wanted to be Joe Rogan. And they were like saying, like, this is what we want to do. And that wasn't really what I was teaching at that time. I was teaching like narrative podcasts, which is more like documentary. So it wasn't like we just have a conversation. It was more like we're going to take a couple of months to make one episode because it's a documentary style. But in a way, those students were kind of showing me what the future was, right? Like they were like, look, that what they were interested in pointed to something that was really becoming really popular, for better or worse. So paying attention to where students' interests are often a way for me to kind of see what's happening. And I also think that, you know, students bring in all kinds of expertise. Sometimes students I'm teaching are in my major, you know, but they might be coming from different disciplines, right? Somebody might be coming from anthropology. Somebody might be coming from engineering. So they bring different expertise that I don't have. I'm not an expert in engineering, you know what I mean? I could barely fix my bike, you know what I'm saying? So, but also I just think interest, right? Like one of the things I like about engaging with young people is just by listening to young folks, hearing what their struggles are, hearing what kind of technology they're using, hearing what it feels like, you know, what their challenges are. It kind of lets me stay tuned to the world and not be like so cordoned off in my own booth as an old professor where I'm locked in and don't understand the world. It's like my students keep me present to what's actually unfolding.
You just mentioned I was mentioning this the other day with somebody, listening. Because you tackle a lot of topics that a lot of people have various different opinions on. And I am a believer that you have to respect opinions, whether you agree with them or not, because you have to just have a respect for people. How do you go about navigating the controversial subjects and listening to what people from all opinions all across the board have to say in your podcasts?
You know, you nailed it. Listening is extremely important, and I think it's something that doesn't happen enough. There's a great book by, I believe the author's name is Kate Murphy, called You're Not Listening. I actually think we're in a listening crisis. I'm going to go there. That's how far I'm going to go. We're going to make radio. We're going to make breaking news. Chenjerai pronounces we are in a listening crisis right now. People don't know how to listen to each other because listening is hard. Let's be honest. Like, sometimes somebody says something, you have something you want to say right away. You don't even want to let them finish. We all know people who keep cutting you off. They can't ever like let you finish a thought. It's hard. And when someone says something that challenges what you think, it makes you feel things, right? You don't want to take those emotions in. So people, there's a lot of reasons not to listen, but listening is really important because our listening crisis, Kate Murphy says, is also linked to our loneliness crisis. So I think listening is really important. And I try to study how to listen. One thing is I try to approach people with curiosity. Everybody has something to teach me. I don't care whether I agree with you. I don't care whether you got degrees or educated or not. Everybody has something to teach me because I haven't walked in your shoes. I haven't lived in this world in your body and know, and I'm not, nine times out of 10, I'm not from where you're from. So that sets me up to be curious. I want to hear everything you got to say. If you disagree with me on an issue, you know, it might be hard for me to listen. I'm human, but I want to hear how you're seeing it. I want to have a genuine curiosity. And that shows up in my show, Empire City. There are people I talk to who are related to the police who I really disagree with, but I was genuinely curious. Like, I want to know, how do you see this? What am I missing? Or what about your experience led you to this perspective? So I think the key is you got to approach the world with curiosity. And you got to always, it has to be about, life has to be about saying, actually, I don't know. Everybody feels like they want to prove what they know. That's one of the reasons why people cut people off. They like, yo, you know, somebody starts telling you, well, you know, I just learned to like, oh, I already know that. I already know that. Everybody wants to tell you what they know. And people hate to be told something that they think they already know. So I think some of it is like calming the ego down a little bit and saying, you know what? What if I don't know? What if I want to approach being a good interviewer is about not knowing, about being curious. And then your curiosity is infectious to the listener. We can be curious and then people can share and then you can get that gift somebody has. You know what I'm saying? That you're never going to get if you cut them off because everybody has a gift of some kind for you, even the people you disagree with. So I'm sorry, Richard, you got me off on a tangent about listening, but you know what I mean? I just listening is so important to me.
No, I would agree with that. And I said just because you disagree with someone doesn't make them a bad person, I think is also something that's important to note. Just because you have a different point of view doesn't make the other person the enemy. Because there can be common ground if you really listen, like you had just mentioned.
I agree. I mean, I also think we have to make spaces to understand that, like, the things people are going through that make them have these opinions, for some people, it's not theoretical. People are going through there's real things happening in the world right now that affect people's lives. And so we have to be able to make space, like you said, to not necessarily make people enemies, but also to like be present to the fact that people are enduring real struggles, real pain. People are enduring death and losing money and people's kids are being, people are being, you know, taken. All these other things are happening and that's real. So we have to make space for people to feel the things they're feeling, but somehow we still have to listen to each other. We can't stop listening.
Now, before we wrap up, you've mentioned your podcasts. What is one thing that you would want listeners, no matter who you are, no matter what your beliefs are, what do you want them to take away from your shows?
Well, I hope you listen. I mean, I hope you enjoy listening. A lot of the content in my podcast is a little darker. Like I deal with some of the more difficult moments of history, but but I hope that people enjoy listening. I try to make something that is pleasurable to listen to, tell you a story. And I just ask people to open your mind and listen and check it out and, you know, and let me know what you think. I mean, and I would also say, you know, it's not just one way. You know, maybe listening to my show will make you curious to go look up some more things, or maybe you have history. 9 times out of 10, you have history. Like just both of y'all, Richard, you have history. I bet if you was to dig into the history of your family and some, you would find some interesting stories there. Your community, same with you, Lydia, you know, in South Africa, you know, you already know. It's like, there's so I think in some ways, I hope people are also inspired for us to get more real history out, and history that doesn't walk away from the difficult questions. It's easier to say, oh, everything's great and my country's great and everything's wonderful and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But like, it's more difficult to walk into the hard parts, you know. So I hope people feel empowered to do that
in their personal lives and just in general. Well, if people want to find out more about you and your podcast, where can they go to?
Wherever you get podcasts, we're there. Empire City is there. Uncivil is there. You know, whatever it is, Spotify, Apple Podcast, whatever your particular medium is. Seen on Radio, I want you to check that out. That's a really, really good show. A wise person once says that the point isn't simply to study society. The point is to change it. So I hope that everybody can also feel inspired to whatever small way or big way you want to take action. I hope people feel that you can get involved, because one of the lessons that I learned about history is we're making history right now. And it's been great making history on the radio with you, Richard, and you, Lydia. Thank you.
And it's been great having you, Chandra. Thanks so much for coming on our show today. So you've been listening to the One World Radio Show on 88.7 FM, WRHU Hempstead, Radio Hofstra University, 88.3 WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech Pittsburgh, and 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, Taylor.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio Program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Soft River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
Peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Come on, the peace train. Is peace train holy rolling?
Everyone jump on the peace train.
89.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, 88.7 WRHU Hempstead, Radio Hofstra University, and 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh, Radio Carnegie Tech. You're listening to the One World Radio Show. I'm your host, Cody Moore. Joining with me is Ricky in New York and Lydia in Cape Town.
Hello, Cody.
Good morning, everyone, and good afternoon, Lydia.
Good morning to everyone, and good off. Yeah.
We are finally having the seasons shift a bit, right? I mean, it went from like 30 or 28 degrees for me to 40 the other day, and I gotta say, I did not like it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just too, I don't know. For me, like, anytime it gets above, like, 70, 75 degrees, it just, at least where I am, it's so humid that I prefer a dry heat. So that's just my personal take.
Oh, really? Lydia doesn't know anything about the heat where she lives.
Not at this moment. Not at this point. We are heading into winter, so on my side,
no.
It's really cold.
Well, we're very honored and privileged that we have a gentleman all the way who the weather in Germany might be where he's coming from might be a little bit different than it is by us. We have Professor Klaus Bernke, who is coming to us from Germany to discuss the topic of cross-cultural psychology. Thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
So I was just...
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history... Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades, Global Edition. One song per decade, 100 years of music in 1 hour. Get ready to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruisin' the Decades, Brad Savage. Brad Savage.
The magic of radio, the power of music. Here we go for Cruisin' the Decades. Over a full century in recorded song, history comes to life. It's cruisinthedecades.com. This is episode number 137. On today's show, Jerry Garcia teams up with David Grisman just years prior to his passing for an album not just for kids. And a wartime tune, World War II, from Dolly Dawn and her Dawn Patrol. Plus, in 2013, the U.S. federal government shut down. And the Ramones cover the Ronettes. Cruisin' the Decades, one song per decade. All styles and sounds are welcome. We're going to start in 1910 with a pretty classic patriotic song. Now, you might know Glenn Miller's popular music version from 1942, but in fact, the song was composed by F.W. Meacham in 1885, a patriotic medley and a song that was recorded by dozens of artists around the turn of the century, 20th century. This was a very popular song in the dawn of the recorded music era, and a big song of World War I, in fact. This is the American Patrol, the U.S. military band. This is from a Wax Cylinder record, 1910, on Cruisin' the Decades. Bye.
hear the improvements in recording technology and the evolution of musical styles of popular music through the decades and beyond. Over 100 years of music. This is the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades. Broadcast worldwide on AM, FM, and shortwave.
Like to tell to you, all night long they sit up on the stairs. He holds her close and starts to coo, my little Margie. I'm always thinking of you, Margie. I'll tell the world I love you. Don't forget your promise to me, 'cause I have bought the home and ring and everything for Margie. You've been my inspiration, days are never blue. After all is said and done, really there is only one, oh Margie, Margie, it's you. Why, my little Margie, do you know that I'd even cut out liquor? Margie, Margie, one kiss and I get chicken. You are like a little doctor to me. Do you know, Margie, that when I'm nervous, you just put me back in service. Margie, Margie. In some cafe, we'll wine and dine the whole night through. And do you know, Margie, when we have had our fill, do you know who'll pay the bill? Oh, Margie, Margie, it's you. Margie, I'm always thinking of you, Margie. I'll tell the world I love you. Don't forget your promise to me, 'cause I have bought the home and ring and everything for Margie. You've been my inspiration, days are never blue. I know who inspired that song. Another good man has gone wrong. Oh, Margie, Margie, it's you.
On Cruisin' the Decades, 100 years of music, one of the most endearing and enduring figures of the 1920s and 30s, and even on into the radio and television era. He made the transition to early TV. That is the famous voice of Eddie Cantor. Catchy little memorable number, Margie, from 1921. Eddie Cantor was a comedian, an actor, dancer and singer, even a film producer and screenwriter, author. I mean, he did it all in showbiz. That's showbiz, baby. Eddie Cantor got his start on the vaudeville stage in the late teens and early 20s, and really was one of the first true pop music stars. Cruisin' the Decades.